J-E-L-L.
The Jell-O Program, starring Jack Benny with Mary Livingston, Phil Harris, Kenny Baker, and yours truly, Don Wilson. The orchestra opens the program with Sing My Heart. Ladies and gentlemen, there are certain words which seem to have a fine, dependable sound, and I think the word genuine is one of them. The dictionary says genuine, real, true, pure, having the character it is claimed to have as a genuine signature. Well, Jell-O measures up to every one of these claims, and the name Jell-O is a genuine signature. Well, that name is a trademark. It's the property of General Foods, and it tells you here is the real thing. If you hear any other gelatin dessert called Jell-O, that's incorrect, for there is no other Jell-O. So whenever you order Jell-O, always order it by name, whether it's from your grocer or in the restaurant. And this is National Restaurant Week, the week of May 8th to May 14th. So when you're dining out, order Jell-O for dessert. Just remember to enjoy Jell-O's delicious extra-rich flavor, as tempting as the real fruit. Be sure to insist by name on genuine Jell-O. Sing My Heart, played by the orchestra. And now, ladies and gentlemen, the spring is here and well underway. Tonight, we bring you a big dose of sulfur and molasses, Jack Benny.
Thank you. Thank you. Hello again. This is Tough to Take Benny coming to you. So hold your nose, folks, and swallow hard. Ain't I awful? You know, Don, we can laugh now about sulfur molasses, but when I was a kid, I hated that stuff, didn't you?
I sure did.
Gee, I remember every time my mother gave it to me, I used to go, ugh.
Ugh?
Yeah. Oh, sometimes I'd go, ish. But as a rule, I'd stick to ugh. It was a colloquial expression in Waukegan.
Well, yeah. Tell me, Jack, did you say ugh for cod liver oil, too?
Ugh for cod liver oil? Heavens no, Don. For cod liver oil, the correct ejaculation is brrr Nagasaki. I remember that distinctly.
Well, that's about the silliest routine I've ever heard. I'm getting out of here before the wagon pulls up.
Well, you're a fine one to criticize, Mr. Harris, with that baby talk of yours.
What baby talk?
I heard you on the air last night singing the Three Little Fishes. Top to the mama fitty top if you can, and defam, wide over the dam. Whee!
Now, wait a minute.
You should have heard him, folks. Boop, boop, diddum, dotum, wadum. You know, Phil, just because you drink like a fish, you don't have to act like one. Imagine a big gawk like you singing Twee Itty Fishy.
Hmm? Well, why shouldn't I? It's a very popular song, and it's sweeping the country.
It is, eh?
Yes, and I get lots and lots of wee twats to ting.
Oh, ooh, do. Well, listen, Phil, don't ting it in here if you want to keep your job. I'm getting sick and tired of you towing off all the time.
Well, I don't care about my job here anyway. I'm in pictures now and doing swell. And if you want to know something, I'm even trying to get rid of my orchestra.
Oh, you are, eh? Well, Phil, for your information, there's an old Chinese proverb that says, do not dump orchestra in ash can until you are out of sane. I found that in a rice cookie. So you better stick to radio, Phil, you and your twee itty fishies.
Oh, cut it out. Cut it out.
Cut it out yourself and cut up. Oh, hello, Mary.
Hello, kiddies. Can an adult get in this conversation?
I think so. Say, Mary, did you ever hear Phil do that baby song, Three Itty Fishies?
Sure, I was over at the Wilshire Bowl the other night and saw him do it. Everybody stopped dancing to watch him.
Got plenty of laughs, didn't I, Mary?
Who wouldn't with those diapers you were wearing?
Oh, dressing for the part, eh?
Yeah, and you want to know something, Jack?
What?
Our maestro is knock-kneed.
Knock-kneed? Hey, I didn't know that.
Oh, she's ribbing, Jack. I ain't knock-kneed.
Go on. You couldn't get a piece of dental floss between those knobs.
Oh, that's a good one. So the big movie star is knock-kneed. That's rich.
Quiet, hoofleg.
Mary, we were discussing Phil. Anyway, we've got a long play to do tonight, so let's all settle down and get started. Where's Kenny?
Kenny? I saw him across the street in the sandwich shop.
Oh.
You should have seen him flirting, Jack. You know, they've got a new waitress over there.
They have?
Bill, come back here. I never saw such a guy.
Well, I'm hungry.
If you're hungry, take a sandwich out of my bucket. It's under the piano, right next to my police dog.
Oh, Jack, why do you have to bring that dog down here? Nobody's going to steal your lunch.
Oh, no? Take a good look at those drooling dipsy doodlers sitting there. I need that dog all right.
Say, Jack, why do you always bring your lunch to the studio anyway?
18 years ago, he lost a hat in a restaurant.
Mary, I've been trying to forget that. So please. Quiet, Baskerville. Say, Mary, what were you saying before about Kenny?
Well, he was in the sandwich shop trying to date up that new waitress. He had 3 malted milks, 2 ice cream sodas, and a banana split before he got her first name.
Ooh, goodness, how could he eat all that stuff?
With a spoon! Ha ha, that's a good one.
Oh, my goodness. I'm going home, that's all. I'm going home. Come on, Baskerville.
What's the matter, Jack? I thought that was pretty quick thinking.
Listen, Ezra. I want you to cut out those ad libs. You've started more bridge games in the middle of our program than anybody on it. You know what kills me, Don? I work and slave over a script all week long. And then on Sunday, the Maharaja walks in and with 3 little words puts us right back on the Chautauqua circuit. With a spoon.
Well, it just came to me and I said it.
And you know, folks, this just came to me.
Oh, fine.
As long as you have a spoon, get a dish, fill it with Jell-O, and you'll have the most tempting gelatin dessert you've ever tasted in your life.
Well, at least, Don, you're sophisticated.
It is economical, easy to make, and comes in 6 delicious flavors. Strawberry, raspberry, cherry, orange, lemon, and lime. Look for the big red letters on the box.
Well, I don't know where we are now, so we might as well have a number. Play something, Phil. Hold it a minute. Come in.
Mr. Benny?
Yes?
Is Phil Harris going to sing 3 Little Fishes tonight?
No, and who are you?
Just a hungry college boy. Goodbye.
I wonder if the CCC boys could plant something on his head. Play, Phil. Rose of the Rio Grande, played by Phil Harris and his Miracle Mile Music Manglers. And just to be fair about it, I must admit that that number was very good. It was swell.
I didn't think it was loud enough.
Not loud enough? Why, Phil, you've got 3 violins in your orchestra, which I know will be startling news to our listening audience. They're plenty loud.
Not for me. I got to put more brass in my band.
More brass? Phil, you've got a trumpet player alone that Gabriel will have a tough time following. That last number, he blew a pompadour right up the back of my neck. Just leave well enough alone, Phil. And now, folks...
Just the same, I need more sock to my music. More volume.
Why don't you put in a burglar alarm?
That's all he needs. And now, folks...
My band may sound all right to you, Jack, but as far as I'm concerned, I don't hear enough brass.
Phil, just pin your curls up over your ears and everything will be ducky. Now, let's get on with our show.
Hey, Jack, look who just came in.
Oh, yes, our sandwich shop, Casanova. Hello, Kenny.
Hello, Jack. Boy, am I sick.
Well, you should be sick. After 3 malted milks, 2 ice cream sodas, and a banana split. All of that just to talk to a girl.
I'm going out with her tonight if I feel better.
Oh, you are, eh?
Yeah, I got her phone number right here in this card. Gee, she's beautiful.
Give me that number, Kenny. I'll hold it for you till you grow up. Come on, give it to me.
I won't.
You give me that or I'll tell your mother.
All right. Here, you stool pigeon.
More like it.
Oh, Jack, you ought to be ashamed of yourself.
Mary, I only took that phone number away from Kenny because he's too young to be going out with girls.
Well, you're too old, so give it a Phil.
Oh, no.
Come on, Jackson, make way for tomorrow.
Phil, you're not getting her number, and neither is Kenny.
You think she'd like a fat boy?
What is this, a grab bag? Now, nobody's getting this girl's number, so forget it.
Looks like she's stuck with Foxy Grandpa.
Mary, I'm merely holding her phone number because Kenny is too young. Let's see this. Oxford 73. Kenny, is this a 3 or a 5?
I'll tell you when I grow up.
Here, you can have it back. I was only kidding.
Say, Kenny, old pal, I got an idea. Why don't you bring your girlfriend over to the Wilshire Bowl tonight? I'll let you lead my band.
You better hang your girl in the check room, Kenny.
You said it, Mary.
And how? You know, Jack, the last time I brought a girl over to Phil's place, Phil came home with us in a cab.
Well, I bet you were plenty burned up, weren't you?
I'll say I had to sit up front with the driver where I couldn't hear the radio.
Oh, so Phil got your girl, eh?
Yeah.
Well, Kenny, for your edification, there's an old Chinese proverb that says, he who introduces girlfriend to Phil Harris had better carry spare. And now, kiddies, let's forget our love life and get on with the program. Ladies and gentlemen, as you all know, yesterday marked another running of that great annual turf classic, the Kentucky Derby. So for our play tonight, we are going...
Oh, by the way, Jack, did you place a bet on the big race yesterday?
Yes, Don, I had $2 on the winner, Johnstown. I had a terrific hunch on him.
That's Jack, all right. He throws away his money like a boomerang.
Now, Mary, that horse wasn't so sure of winning.
You didn't play him to win.
Oh, that's right. I had him to show. Getting back to our play, as I was saying, folks, yesterday was the running of the Great Kentucky Derby. So tonight, the Benny Perry Mutual Players will present an original play dedicated to this outstanding event. This will go on...
Hey, is this the Jello program?
What? Why, Andy Devine, the old mayor of Van Nuys himself. Come on in.
Hiya, Buck!
Gee, I haven't seen him in a long time. Andy, gee, I haven't seen you in weeks. Why don't you drop around once in a while?
Well, I've been pretty busy on the farm, Buck. You know, it's spring, and I've been doing all the planting and plowing, and it's a lot of work for one man.
I'll bet it is. Hey, well, doesn't your pa do anything on the farm?
No, Buck, he's got a system.
Oh.
He makes cider in the fall, bottles it in the winter, drinks it in the spring, and sleeps all summer.
Well, at least he's happy. But, Andy, with all you got to do, I should think you'd try and get a little work out of your paw.
Oh, I don't trust him, Buck. Last year he took a couple of snorts and plowed up Highway 99.
Well, I'm glad you found time to come down to see us. Say, Andy, how's your maw?
Oh, she's fine, Buck. Pa took her up to the San Francisco Fair last week.
Well, that was nice.
He tried to get her a job with Sally Rand, but they turned her down.
They turned her down? Why?
She's got your trouble, Buck. Bow legs.
Now, wait a minute. The next one on this program that says I've got bow legs has got to chase a pig through them.
It's a cinch.
Never mind. Say, Andy, how do you happen to be in town today?
Well, I come down to pick up my girl. She just got a job across the street in that sandwich shop.
In the sandwich shop?
Jeepers creepers, I'm cooked.
Serves you right, Kenny. Say, Andy, I don't suppose I ought to tell you this, but Kenny happens to have your girl's phone number.
Let it ring, Buck. I'll answer it.
Hey, you're pretty sharp. Well, now that you're here, Andy, I hope you can stick around because tonight we're doing a play about the Kentucky Derby. And I think we can find a spot in it for you. What do you say?
Okay, Buck. I hope I'm a jockey.
We'll see, Andy. And now, folks, Kenny Baker, our young tenor, will sing. What are you going to sing, Kenny?
Penny Serenade. It's a request.
Oh, who requested it?
Andy's girl, so I'm just going to sing it mediocre.
Now, Kenny, you mustn't let your personal feelings influence your song. Remember, you're a trooper.
You're right, Jack. I'll sing like I've never sung before. The show must go on.
What a clock.
You said it. Sing, Pagliacci.
My love song for a penny. See, 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 just a penny serenade. Once I strayed neath a window of a lovely, lovely lady, and she smiled while I softly played my penny serenade. In her eyes shone the tender dawn of love and sweet surrender. As for me, in my heart I played a lover's serenade. See, see, you can hear it for a penny. Just a penny serenade. See, 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 hear my love song for a penny. See, 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 just a penny serenade. In a dream so divine, she was mine. No word had been spoken. When I woke from my dream, she was gone. My poor heart was broken. Still I pray that wherever she may be, she will remember. In her heart, she will always hear my penny serenade. Serenade, sung by Kenny Baker. And now, ladies and gentlemen, without further ado, we will bring you our tribute to the Kentucky Derby by presenting a little play in two scenes and three furlongs entitled Weather Clear, Track Fast, Fine Play, Bum Cast. Now, in this turf drama, we will all play the parts of horses. I mean, we will all play horses. Pardon me, huh? This is silly. I'm not going to be a horse.
Kenny, if I can get down on my hands and knees, you can.
Only he can get up.
I can get up too, so don't be so smart. Well, that's settled. We're all going to be horses.
I'd like to see somebody put a saddle on me.
Quiet, El Chico. And pin on your tail. I want this to be realistic. Now, before presenting this play, folks, I would like to announce that any resemblance to horses, living, dead, or under General Sherman, is purely coincidental. The opening scene is the paddock at Churchill Downs, 20 minutes before the big race, where we find El Chico, Johnstown, Technician, Shaladon, Heather Broom, On Location, and all the other entries chewing the fat. Curtain. Music. We're horses now, folks. Oh, Shaladon, Shaladon.
Yes, Technician.
You better lay off those oats. No, you've been putting on a lot of weight.
Oh, I'm not so heavy.
You're not. You're the only horse in this stable with a double chin, and you know it. Say, Shaladon, look at El Chico over there with that curly mane of his. That's a finger wave if I ever saw one. What are you eating, El Chico?
Corn.
I thought so. I suppose you think you're going to win today.
Why, pal, my tail will be in your face all around that track.
Oh, it will, eh?
Yeah.
Listen, El Chico, if your tail comes anywhere near my mouth, I'll bob it. So watch out. Oh, hello, Heather Broom. What are you reading?
A letter from my brother. He's with Borden's Dairy now.
Oh. Isn't he pulling that ice wagon anymore?
No, he got cold feet.
I see. See, I hope I don't wind up on a milk wagon. I hate those early hours. Well, Heather Broom, good luck to you today.
Hey, Heather, what are you doing after the race tonight?
Oh, nothing. Let's go over to the Blue Moon Livery Stable. They have a marvelous floor show.
They have? Who's playing there?
Pink's Mules.
Oh, they're wonderful. There's a little brunette on the end. Well.
How about going there with me tonight, Heather?
It's a date. I've got a beautiful new blanket I'm going to wear. It's from Sac Bay Meadows.
Now, wait a minute, El Chico. Heather has a date with me tonight, and I'm going to pick her up at 8 o'clock.
8 o'clock? You won't be coming into the stretch till 10.
I won't, eh? They clocked me this morning, brother, and I heard my trainer say, if I get on the rail at the first turn, I'll jive right in. So there.
Hey, fellas, there's Johnstown over there. Gee, he's swell-headed.
Yeah, I think he's smart because he's a favorite. Look at him getting a hoof-a-cure. What does he think he is, anyway?
Well, here comes On Location.
Oh, yeah.
Hiya, fellas.
Hello, On. You think you've got a chance today?
I will if it's a wet track. You know, I'm a terrific mudder.
You should be. You don't know enough to come in out of the rain.
Now, Heather.
Well, I'm 40-1 today, Smarty.
Well, that's nothing to brag about.
It ain't, huh? I'd be 60-1 if people knew I had that banana split.
I wouldn't be surprised. Chaladon, I told you to lay off those oats.
Well, I'm starved.
I know, but passing you on the track now is practically a detour. My goodness. Darn these flies. Get away from me, you old horse fly.
I want Chaladon. There's meat on him.
Cat, shoo. Well, fellas, we still got a few minutes to kill before the race. What'll we do?
How about pitching a game of horseshoes?
Oh, I don't want to take them off just for that. Say, who's that new white horse in the stall across the way? They just unloaded him this morning.
Haven't you heard? That's Abdul the Third, an Arabian horse.
Oh, an Arabian, eh? I must get acquainted. Hello, Abdul.
Hello, stranger.
My name is Technician. Where are you from? I mean, what's your lineage?
Are you alluding to me?
Yes, where are you from?
I'm out of the Filter Girl by Bagel Boy.
Oh, yes, I read about your family in the Breeders' Digest. You come from very good stock.
Why, certainly. You ain't talking to our club, you know.
Well, I appreciate that. By the way, Abdul, why aren't you in the big race today?
I should get high blood pressure for a bag of oats.
Oh, come on, run in the race.
No, not me, partner.
Oh, come on, don't be so stubborn.
I can't help it. I got mule blood in me.
Well, you'd never know it. Hey, that's for us, fellas. We better get going. So long, Abdul.
Good luck, Technician.
Gee, I'm nervous.
Darn it, I can't find my blinkers.
Gosh, my mane looks beautiful. I bet I get a big hand.
El Chico, put down that mirror. You're a fine 3-year-old. Look at those bags under your eyes. Well, come on, tails up, everybody. We're off to the race. Gee, hey, look at that crowd. We're sure packing them in today, huh?
Well, folks, here come the horses up to the barrier, ready for the big race. Oh, it's a lovely day here at Churchill Downs. I wish you could see these beautiful bangtails prancing up to the post.
Bangtails, I hate that word.
They're lining up, folks. There's Johnstown, the favorite, Chaladon, Heather Broom, El Chico, and On Location.
Didn't even mention me. Hey, move over, El Chico. You want the whole track?
Quiet, you old gray mare.
I'm not a mare.
Then take your hoof off your hip.
That's where the fly bit me.
There's a little trouble down there, folks. Technician is glaring at El Chico.
You're darn right I am.
And now Heather Broom is acting up. Seems to be quite temperamental.
What's the matter with you, Heather? Stop fidgeting.
Well, my girdle's too tight.
That's a saddle. How are you going to run in those high-heeled shoes? Who's your blacksmith, anyway?
I. Miller.
Oh. I know him. He used to shoe my mother when she ran at Saratoga.
The horses are calming down now. They're all lined up. All except one who's facing the wrong way.
That's me, folks. Wouldn't you know it?
Yes, turn around.
On location, it's back in line now, and it looks like we're going to have...
Yes, we're off!
And there they go! They broke clean and fast, and Johnstown takes the lead, followed closely by El Chico. T.M. Dorset is third. Then comes Heatherbroom, Viscounty, On Location, and Chaladon.
Hey, what am I, an orphan?
And oh, yes, there's Technician, puffing hard.
I am not.
Oh, folks, what a race. Johnstown is still in the lead by 2 lengths. El Chico second, Heatherbroom third, and Technician is doing the best he can with those bow legs.
I'd like to kick him right in the face.
They're rounding the far turn now, folks, and coming into the stretch, Johnstown is leading by 3 miles.
Don't exaggerate.
Chaladon and Heatherbroom are moving up. Looks like they're going to finish in the money.
I'm going to finish in the money, too.
You wouldn't if you ever spent any.
Oh, yeah?
Wow, look at that Johnstown run. He's still way in the lead. And look, folks, here comes Malicious on the outside.
Malicious? He isn't even running.
Quiet! They're nearing the finish line, folks. Here they come. They're crossing the wire. And here are the winners. Johnstown first by 8 miles and 6 lengths. Chaladon second by a length and a half. Heatherbroom third by a head. Technician fifth by a nose.
I was robbed.
And On Location last by courtesy of Mervyn LeRoy.
Gee, I'm all in.
And here's the winner, Johnstown, coming up to the microphone. Say something, Johnstown.
Put the oats on, Ma. I'll be right home.
Oh, what a race. Play, El Chico.
Here's a dessert that's as gay and cheerful to look at as this year's new hats. It's very inexpensive, and it's quick and easy to make. Picture to yourself a gay yellow dessert bowl piled high with smooth, rich, jello chocolate pudding, decorated with fluffs of whipped cream, and topped with bright red maraschino cherries. Yes, ma'am, it is a picture, and just as good to eat as it looks, for jello chocolate pudding brings you that old-fashioned homemade goodness. It has a perfect texture, a rich, tempting color, and it's as easy as can be to make. All three new Jell-O puddings are simple to prepare. The directions are in every package, and they cook in next to no time. And all three taste grand. Jell-O butterscotch pudding, rich with true butterscotch flavor. Jell-O vanilla pudding, delicate and creamy and tempting. Buy 3 packages at a time. Ask your grocer tomorrow for Jell-O chocolate, butterscotch, and vanilla pudding. The real homemade kind.
Last number of the 32nd program in the new Jell-O series. And we will be with you again next Sunday night at the same time when we will present our version of Pandro S. Berman's great RKO production, Gunga Din. Don't miss it, folks. India, elephants, camels, soldiers, drums, bugles, and I will be Gunga Din.
You got nice legs for it.
Quiet. Good night, folks.
Kenny Baker appears on the Jell-O program to courtesy of Mervyn LeRoy Productions.
The selection, Sing My Heart, is from Love Affair. This is the National Broadcasting Company.
This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. What I Saw in America by G.K. Chesterton. Section 1, Chapter 1, Part 1. What is America? I have never managed to lose my old conviction that travel narrows the mind. At least a man must make a double effort of moral humility and imaginative energy to prevent it from narrowing his mind. Indeed, there is something touching and even tragic about the thought of the thoughtless tourist who might have stayed at home, loving Laplanders, embracing Chinamen, and clasping Patagonians to his heart in Hampstead or Surbiton, but for his blind and suicidal impulse to go and see what they looked like. This is not meant for nonsense. Still less is it meant for the silliest sort of nonsense, which is cynicism. The human bond that he feels at home is not an illusion. On the contrary, it is rather an inner reality. Man is inside all men. In a real sense, any man may be inside any men. But to travel is to leave the inside and draw dangerously near the outside. So long as he thought of men in the abstract, like naked toiling figures in some classic frieze, merely as those who labor and love their children and die, he was thinking the fundamental truth about them. But going to look at their unfamiliar manners and customs, he is inviting them to disguise themselves in fantastic masks and costumes. Many modern internationalists talk as if men of different nationalities had only to meet and mix and understand each other. In reality, this is the moment of supreme danger, the moment when they meet. We might shiver as at the old euphemism by which a meeting meant a duel. Travel ought to combine amusement with instruction. But most travelers are so much amused that they refuse to be instructed. I do not blame them for being amused. It is perfectly natural to be amused at a Dutchman for being Dutch, or a Chinaman for being Chinese. Where they are wrong is that they take their own amusement seriously. They base on it their serious ideas of international instruction. It was said that the Englishman takes his pleasures sadly, and the pleasure of despising foreigners is one which he takes most sadly of all. He comes to scoff, and does not remain to pray, but rather to excommunicate. Hence, in international relations, there is far too little laughing and far too much sneering. But I believe there is a better way, which largely consists of laughter, a form of friendship between nations which is actually founded on differences. To hint at some such better way is the only excuse of this book. Let me begin my American impressions with two impressions I had before I went to America. One was an incident and the other an idea, and when taken together they illustrate the attitude I mean. The first principle is that nobody should be ashamed of thinking a thing funny because it is foreign. The second is that he should be ashamed of thinking it wrong because it is funny. The reaction of his senses and superficial habits of mind against something new, and to him abnormal, is a perfectly healthy reaction. But the mind which imagines that mere unfamiliarity can possibly prove anything about inferiority is a very inadequate mind. It is inadequate even in criticizing things that may really be inferior to the things involved here. It is far better to laugh at a negro for having a black face than to sneer at him for having a sloping skull. It is proportionally even more preferable to laugh rather than judge in dealing with highly civilized peoples. Therefore, I put at the beginning two working examples of what I felt about America before I saw it, the sort of thing that a man has a right to enjoy as a joke, and the sort of thing he has a duty to understand and respect, because it is the explanation of the joke. When I went to the American consulate to regularize my passports, I was capable of expecting the American consulate to be American. Embassies and consulates are by tradition like islands of the soil for which they stand, and I have often found the tradition corresponding to a truth. I have seen the unmistakable French official living on omelets and a little wine and serving his sacred abstractions under the last palm trees fringing a desert. In the heat and noise of quarreling Turks and Egyptians, I have come suddenly, as with the cool shock of his own shower-bath, on the listless amiability of the English gentleman. The officials I interviewed were very American, especially in being very polite, for whatever may have been the mood or meaning of Martin Chuzzlewit, I've always found Americans by far the politest people in the world. They put in my hands a form to be filled up, to all appearance like other forms I had filled up in other passport offices. But in reality, it was very different from any form I had ever filled up in my life. At least it was a little like a freer form of the game called Confessions, which my friends and I invented in our youth. An examination paper containing questions like, "If you saw a rhinoceros in the front garden, what would you do?" One of my friends, I remember, wrote, "Take the pledge." But that is another story, and might bring Mr. Pussyfoot Johnson on the scene before his time. One of the questions of the paper was, "Are you an anarchist?" To which a detached philosopher would naturally feel inclined to answer, "What the devil has that to do with you? Are you an atheist?" along with some playful efforts to cross-examine the official about what constitutes a Greek arch. Then there was the question, "Are you in favor of subverting the government of the United States by force?" Against this, I should write, I prefer to answer that question at the end of my tour and not the beginning. The inquisitor, in his more than morbid curiosity, had then written down, "Are you a polygamist?" The answer to this is, "No such luck," or "Not such a fool," according to our experience of the other sex. But perhaps a better answer would be that given by W. T. Stead when he circulated the rhetorical question, "Shall I slay my brother boar?" The answer that ran, "Never interfere in family matters." But among many things that amused me most to the point of treating the form thus disrespectfully, the most amusing was the thought of the ruthless outlaw who should feel compelled to treat it respectfully. I like to think of the foreign desperado seeking to slip into America with official papers under official protection, and sitting down to write with a beautiful gravity, "I am an anarchist, I hate you all, and wish to destroy you," or "I intend to subvert by force the government of the United States as soon as possible," sticking the long sheath knife in my left trouser pocket into Mr. Harding at the earliest opportunity. Or again, "Yes, I am a polygamist all right, and my 47 wives are accompanying me on the voyage, disguised as secretaries." There seems to be a certain simplicity of mind about these answers, and it is reassuring to know that anarchists and polygamists are so pure and good that the police have only to ask them questions and they're certain to tell no lies. Now that is a model of the sort of foreign practice, founded on foreign problems, at which a man's first impulse is naturally to laugh. Nor have I any intention of apologizing for my laughter. A man is perfectly entitled to laugh at a thing because he happens to find it incomprehensible. What he has no right to do is laugh at it as incomprehensible, and then criticize it as if he comprehended it. The very fact of its unfamiliarity and mystery ought to set him thinking about the deeper causes that make people so different from himself, and that without merely assuming that they must be inferior to himself. Superficially, this is rather a queer business. It would be easy enough to suggest that in this America has introduced a quite abnormal spirit of inquisition, an interference with liberty unknown among all the ancient despotisms and aristocracies. About that there will be something to be said later, but superficially it is true that this degree of officialism is comparatively unique. In a journey which I took only the year before, I had occasion to have my papers passed by governments which many worthy people in the West would vaguely identify with corsairs and assassins. I have stood on the other side of Jordan, and in the land ruled by the rude Arab chief, where the police looked so like brigands that one wondered what the brigands looked like. But they did not ask me whether I had come to subvert the powers of Sharif. They did not exhibit the faintest curiosity about my personal views on the ethical basis of civil authority. These ministers of ancient Moslem despotism did not care about whether I was an anarchist, and naturally would not have minded if I had been a polygamist. The Arab chief was probably a polygamist himself. These slaves of Asiatic autocracy were content, in the old liberal fashion, to judge me by my actions. They did not inquire into my thoughts. They held their power as limited to the limitation of practice. They did not forbid me to hold a theory. It would be easy to argue here that Western democracy persecutes where even Eastern despotism tolerates or emancipates. it would be easy to develop the fancy that, as compared with the sultans of Turkey or Egypt, the American Constitution is a thing like the Spanish Inquisition. Only the traveller who stops at that point is totally wrong, and the traveller only too often does stop at that point. He has found something to make him laugh, and he will not suffer it to make him think. And the remedy is not to unsay what he has said, not even, so to speak, to unlaugh what he has laughed, not to deny that there is something unique and curious about this American Inquisition into our abstract opinions, but rather to continue the train of thought and follow the admirable advice of Mr. H. G. Wells, who said, "It is not much good thinking of a thing unless you think it out." It is not to deny that American officialism is rather peculiar in this point, but to inquire what it really is which makes America peculiar, or which is peculiar to America. In short, it is to get some ultimate idea of what America is, and the answer to that question will reveal something much deeper and grander, and more worthy of our intelligent interest. It may have seemed something less than a compliment to compare the American Constitution to the Spanish Inquisition, but oddly enough, it does involve a truth, and still more oddly, perhaps, it does involve a compliment. The American Constitution does resemble the Spanish Inquisition in this, that it is founded on a creed. America is the only nation in the world that is founded on a creed. That creed is set forth with dogmatic and even theological lucidity in the Declaration of Independence. Perhaps the only piece of practical politics that is also theoretical politics and also great literature. It enunciates that all men are equal in their claim to justice, that governments exist to give them that justice, and that their authority is for that reason just. It certainly does condemn anarchism, and it does also, by inference, condemn atheism, since it clearly names the Creator as the ultimate authority from whom these equal rights are derived. Nobody expects a modern political system to proceed logically in the application of such dogmas, and in the matter of God and government, it is naturally God whose claim is taken more lightly. The point is that there is a creed, if not about the divine, at least about human things. Now a creed is at once the broadest and the narrowest thing in the world. In its nature, it is as broad as its scheme for brotherhood of all men. In its nature, it is limited by its definition of the nature of all men. This was true of the Christian Church, which was truly said to exclude neither Jew nor Greek, but which did definitely substitute something else for Jewish religion or Greek philosophy. It was truly said to be a net drawing in all of kinds, but a net of a certain pattern, the pattern of Peter the fisherman. And this is true even of the most disastrous distortions or degradations of that creed, and true among others of the Spanish Inquisition. It may have been narrow touching theology, it could not confess to being narrow about nationality or ethnology. The Spanish Inquisition might be admittedly inquisitorial, but the Spanish Inquisition could not be merely Spanish. Such a Spaniard, even when he was narrower than his own creed, had to be broader than his own empire. He might burn a philosopher because he was a heterodox, but he must accept a barbarian because he was orthodox. And we see, even in modern times, that the same church which is blamed for making sages heretics is also blamed for making savages priests. Now, in a much vaguer and more evolutionary fashion, there is something of the same idea at the back of the great American experiment, the experiment of a democracy of diverse races, which has been compared to a melting pot. But even that metaphor implies that the pot itself is of a certain shape and a certain substance, a pretty solid substance. The melting pot must not melt. The original shape was traced on the lines of Jeffersonian democracy, and it will remain in that shape until it becomes shapeless. America invites all men to become citizens, but it implies the dogma that there is such a thing as citizenship. Only so far as its primary ideal is concerned, its exclusiveness is religious, because it is not racial. The missionary can condemn a cannibal precisely because he cannot condemn a Sandwich Islander. And in something of the same spirit, the American may exclude a polygamist, precisely because he cannot exclude a Turk. Now for America, this is no idle theory. It may have been theoretical, though it was thoroughly sincere when that great Virginian gentleman declared in surroundings that had still something of the character of an English countryside. It is not merely theoretical now. There is nothing to prevent America being literally invaded by Turks, as she is invaded by Jews or Bulgars. In the most exquisitely inconsequent of the Bab ballads, we are told concerning Pasha Bailey Ben. One morning knocked at 8:30, a tall red Indian at his gate. In Turkey, as perhaps aware, red Indians are extremely rare. But the converse need by no means be true. There is nothing in the nature of things to prevent an immigration of Turks increasing and multiplying on the plains where the red Indians wandered. There is nothing to necessitate the Turks being extremely rare. The red Indians, alas, are likely to be rarer. And as I much prefer red Indians to Turks, not to mention Jews, I speak without prejudice. But the point here is that America, partly by original theory and partly by historical accident, does lie open to racial admixtures which most countries would think incongruous or comic. That is why it is only fair to read any American definitions or rules in a certain light, and relative to a rather unique position. It is not fair to compare the position of those who may meet Turks in the back street with that of those who have never met Turks except in the Bab ballads. It is not fair simply to compare America with England in its regulations about the Turk. In short, it is not fair to do what almost every Englishman probably does, to look at the American International Examination paper and laugh and be satisfied with saying, "We don't have any of that nonsense in England." We do not have any of that nonsense in England, because we have never attempted to have any of that philosophy in England, and above all because we have the enormous advantage of feeling it natural to be national, because there is nothing else to be. England in these days is not well governed. England is not well educated. England suffers from wealth and poverty that are not well distributed. But England is English. England is English as France is French, or Ireland Irish. The great mass of men taking certain national traditions for granted. Now this gives us a totally different and a very much easier task. We have not got an Inquisition because we have not got a creed. But it is arguable that we do not need a creed because we have got a character. In any of the old nations, the national unity is preserved by the national type. Because we have a type, we do not need to have a test. The end of Section 1, Chapter 1, Part 1.
The Jell-O program, starring Jack Benny with Mary Livingston, Phil Harris, Kenny Baker, and yours truly, Don Wilson. The orchestra opens the program with "You've Got Everything." You remember this popular song called "You've Got Everything"? Well, you know, that song might well have been dedicated to Jell-O, for really there is one dessert that does have everything. Color, bright, sunshiny, and gay. Flavor, extra rich, cool, and refreshing, as tempting as the real ripe fruit. Ease and speed, for Jell-O dissolves instantly and sets quickly. Economy, Jell-O costs only a few cents a package, and one package serves the average family generously. And variety, for Jell-O offers you dozens and dozens of delicious new dishes. Serve it plain in a colorful mold of beauty. Garnish it with whipped cream or any seasonal fruits. Use it for salads, for Jell-O makes swell salads that even the men folks go for. Yes, sir, one box of Jell-O is filled with real kitchen magic, the kind that every busy woman appreciates. So ask your grocer tomorrow for Jell-O. Look for those big red letters on the box. They spell Jell-O, and Jell-O spells a treat. was You've Got Everything, played by the orchestra. And now, ladies and gentlemen, we bring you Hollywood's newest glamour boy, Jack Benny.
Thank you. Thank you. Hello again. This is Jack Benny talking. And Don, I appreciate your calling me a glamour boy, but really that's not quite my classification.
Oh, it isn't?
No, Don. According to the latest publicity from Paramount, I'm the oomph man. Oomph.
Yes. The oomph man?
Yeah, you see, Don, a glamour boy is merely good looking. But when a star has, in addition to that, a certain charm and appeal to women, then he becomes an oomph man, which is me.
You better stay out of the hot sun, brother.
Oh, you're here already. Listen, Phil, I'm not a fortune teller and I'm not psychic, but I see you soon scattering your brilliant remarks in greener pastures. And hello. You know, Don, ever since we switched the ending of the picture, Man About Town, and I married Dorothy L'Amour, Phil has been a wreck. So jealous because I'm a ladies' man.
Me jealous? Why, every girl you go out with regards you as a big brother.
Well, that's part of my technique. I sneak up on them. So don't be so sour grapesy.
Oh, by the way, Jack, last week you had an argument with the studio about Rochester. Are you going to let him be in the picture?
Rochester? Oh, he's in it already, Don, and am I having trouble with him at the house? The airs he's been putting on.
Oh, getting ritzy, huh?
Ritzy? He bought a sport coat yesterday with three belts in the back. Not only that, it's getting so he won't wear anything but silk underwear.
Well, it's all right for him to wear silk underwear, isn't it?
Not when the monogram says J.B. No, sir.
Jack, I can't understand why you keep Rochester when he causes you so much trouble. Why don't you fire him?
Oh, I can't. You see, he found the treasure map of my backyard and won't give it back. But I'll get him in time.
Hello, Jack.
Oh, hello, Mary. Say, Mary, have you heard the latest? They changed the ending of the picture, and instead of Phil getting Dorothy L'Amour, I'm the one that marries her.
Yes, I know. She's sick about it.
She's nothing of the kind. You're just making that up because Dorothy happens to be very fond of me. In fact, the other day she gave me an autographed sarong.
How do you look in it?
Gorgeous. Are you surprised?
Oh, Mary, Jack's got a new one. He says that everybody at Paramount's calling him the oomph man.
Yeah, but did Jack tell you how he got the title?
Quiet.
The director punched him in the stomach and he went, oomph.
That's not the reason at all. They call me the oomph man because in this picture I'm virile and rugged.
Oh, yeah? Tell them what happened when you shot the wedding scene yesterday afternoon.
Oh, well, that was just a novelty, that's all. Something different.
What was it, Mary?
Yeah, tell him.
Oh.
Well, after Jack marries Dorothy, he's supposed to pick her up in his arms and carry her across the threshold.
Mary.
Well, Jack tried and tried, but he couldn't lift her.
And what happened?
She carried him across.
Mary, I told you it was just a novelty, something original.
Well, say, Jack, did you feel kind of silly being carried in a girl's arms?
Well, I didn't mind being in her arms, Don, but when she started to rock me, I thought that was going to... Anyway, let's drop the whole thing because we've got an important sketch to do tonight. Where's Kenny? Hey, Kenny! Kenny!
What?
It's time for your song.
Well, wait till I get through. The drummer's teaching me how to play poker.
Well, tell him to give you your shirt back and come over here.
Okay.
Phil, I wish you'd tell your boys not to take advantage of Kenny. He's too young to gamble.
Oh, yeah? I got over 1,000 marbles hid under my mattress.
I don't care what you've got. I don't want you learning how to play cards.
I got a fine chance to grow up around here.
Never mind. I don't want any more gambling. Now go ahead, young man, and sing your song.
I will not.
You will, too.
I tell you what. I'll match you 2 songs or nothing.
Kenny, sing your song and not another word out of you. Hold it a minute. There's the phone.
I'll bet $5 it's for me.
Quiet. Hello? Yes? Oh, he's right here, Mrs. Wilson. It's for you, Don. It's your wife.
Oh, thanks. Hello, dear. Yes, I know we're having company for dinner. Oh, that's up to you, dear. Any flavor will do. Well, strawberry or raspberry would be swell.
Don, we've got a long play today.
We haven't had cherry in a long time. What about orange, darling?
Don, we've got a long plate.
Oh, I know. Let's have lemon.
Don't forget lime. You might as well get them all in.
Well, look, sweetheart, it's all up to you if you want a real tempting and economical dessert.
Give me that phone. Hello, Mrs. Wilson. Look for the big red letters on the box and hang up. We've got a play to do. Sing, Kenny. That was a frame-up if I ever heard one.
When the somber shadows of the night grow dim and the daylight dawns on the hillock's brim, in the black of the night by the light of the moon, on the top of the day when the clock is at noon, no matter what the hour, I'm a slave in the grip of your power. Melancholy mood forever haunts me, steals upon me in the night. Forever taunts me, oh, what a lonely soul am I, stranded high and dry by melancholy mood. Gone is every joy and inspiration, tears are all I have to show. No consolation, all I can see is grief and gloom, till the crack of doom, oh, melancholy mood. Deep in the night I search for a trace of a lingering kiss, a warm embrace, but love is a whimsy as flimsy as lace, and my arms embrace an empty space. Melancholy mood, why must you blind me? Pity me and break the chains that bind me. Won't you release and set me free? Bring her back to me, oh, melancholy moon. Deep in the night I search for a trace of a lingering kiss, a warm embrace, but love is a whimsy as flimsy as lace, and my arms embrace an empty space. Melancholy mood, why must you blind me, pity me, and break the chains that bind me, won't you release and set me free, bring her back to me, oh, melancholy mood.
That was Melancholy Mood, sung by Kenny Baker. And, Kenny, that was a swell song, a natural for you.
I threw a seven, huh?
Kenny. And now, ladies and gentlemen, we have a great treat in store for you. Last week, the Benny Gypsies gave you their interpretation of Gunga Din, which took place in faraway India. And tonight, to show you that we get around, we take you to Boston, Massachusetts, and present our version of Daryl F. Zanuck's outstanding 20th Century Fox production, that grand tribute to a great man and famous scientist, Alexander Graham Bell. Thank you.
Can I go home now, Mr. Benny? I'm all in.
Not yet, Jojo. Now, as you all know, Don Ameche portrayed the famous inventor in the picture. So in our version, I will naturally play the title role.
May I ask why?
Certainly. Now, this picture also featured...
I said, why should you be Alexander Graham Bell?
Well, for one thing, Phil, the part fits me. I used to be an inventor myself. Wasn't I, Mary?
Oh, Jack, you weren't the first one to think of putting a mouse trap in a wallet.
I don't mean that. Years ago, when I was in the Navy, I invented a chin rest for portholes. They went over very big. Now, getting back to our play, Mary, you will be my wife, as portrayed on the screen by that sweet, gorgeous, beautiful, and talented young actress,
Lovely Loretta Young.
Well, if you think she's so good, why didn't you get her?
Don't think I didn't try. We're quite good friends, you know, but she had a previous engagement.
Listen, Dreamer, you're not even acquainted with Loretta Young.
I'm not, eh? It might interest you to know, Phil, that I've got Loretta's address right in my little book.
What book?
Guide to the Movie Star's Home.
I mean my little red book. Now, Kenny...
Yes, Jack?
Kenny, when the play opens, I'm a poor, struggling inventor, and you're a wealthy businessman who finances my experiments. Do you think you can handle it?
I'll lay you 3-1, I can.
Now, Kenny... The last time, I don't want to hear another word about gambling. You're too young. Anyway, you're going to be my backer. And as I was saying, Mary, you're going to be my patient, loyal wife. We've had a hard struggle. I'm trying to invent the telephone, and everybody thinks I'm a madman. They think I'm eccentric. They think I'm crazy. But you, my little wife, what do you think?
What do you think?
Mary, will you please get in the mood for Pete's sake? Now, the locale...
Say, Alexander, am I going to be in this?
Yes, Phil, you're going to be my assistant who helps me invent the telephone.
But, Jack, I'm a musician, not a mechanic.
Listen, Phil, I'd rather have you tinker with my toaster than tamper with Tannhauser. Any day. Now, our dramatic offering will go on immediately after a number by... Oh, come in.
Hello, Mr. Bennett.
Hello, Rochester. What do you want?
Say, boss, are you in a pleasant frame of mind this evening, or are you cloaked in gloom?
I'm feeling very good, Rochester. Why?
Well, I got some news that may turn your dabber down.
What? What are you talking about?
Boss, remember when you and I were driving down to the studio in your car tonight?
Yes.
And when the motor kept stalling, you got mad and said, you wish somebody would steal this thing?
Yes.
Well, hallelujah, you're a pedestrian.
A pedestrian?
That's from the Latin.
I know where it's from. You mean to say somebody stole my car?
Well, all I know is I parked the car in front of the studio and went across the street to buy a cigar.
Uh-huh.
And when I got back, there was nothing there but the anchor.
Oh, that's awful. Now, who would want to steal my car?
Somebody that goes...
Now, don't be funny. My car's been stolen, and it's nothing to clown about.
Tell me, Jack, did you have any insurance on it?
Only tornado. Ding the luck. Rochester, this is all your fault.
I'm sorry, boss.
Well, it's too late now to be sorry. Now, I want you to go right down to the police station and report the loss. Hurry up.
I ain't going near that police station.
Why not?
I'm behind in my alimony.
Alimony? Why, Rochester, I didn't know you'd been married.
Oh, boss, repeatedly.
Well, that's your business. Now get going.
Okay, goodbye.
So long.
Oh, say, Rochester, I see you're playing a part in our picture.
Yeah, that's right.
How you coming along?
Mr. Harris, I'm in the groove, on the beam, and dog victory. So long.
He's the biggest ham I ever saw.
The biggest, Jack?
Yes, the biggest. And I'm going to get out that car back if I have to offer a reward. Play, Phil. Now, where would I go if I were a Maxwell?
Thank you.
dog is a bug in a rug. Whenever you hold me tight, cozy and warm on the chilliest night. Just as snug as a bug in a rug. Whenever I feel your kiss, talk about home, home is never like this. First your arms come stealing, and my heart goes on a roller coaster. Then I get that feeling like a little piece of toast in a toaster. Gee, but my life would be cold without your delicious hug, keeping me snug as a bug in a rug.
Well, that was Snug as a Bug in a Rug, played by a mug in his lungs. How was that, Phil?
Thanks for the plug, slug.
Going from that neat bit of comedy to our dramatic highlight of the season, we are now going to offer our contribution to the annals of scientific progress. That epic of American ingenuity, Alexander Graham Bell. Wait for me. Now, the locale of our play is Boston, Massachusetts, in the year 1870. The scene is the little attic laboratory where we find Professor Bell and his assistant, Mr. Harris, working feverishly on their great invention, the telephone. Mrs. Bell has just entered the room. Curtain. Music.
I'll take it. Hello? Alexander Graham Bell's residence. What? No, you can't talk to him. He's busy inventing the telephone. Goodbye.
I'll say I am. Oh, Mr. Harris. Mr. Harris.
Yes, Professor Bell.
I think I've got something here. Hand me that duplex circuit repeater and the multiple induction coil. I'll attach them to the supervisory electromagnetic oscillator.
You're kidding.
I am not. Now, give me a hand. Give me a hand with this quadruplex frictional deflector.
Okay, here's the metallic cylindrical felicitator.
What's that?
The screwdriver.
Oh, trying to top me, eh? Wait a minute. I'll use this little hammer. There, that's coming along all right.
Say, Alex, I wish you'd hurry up and invent this telephone. A blonde gave me her number this morning, and I want to call her up.
Has she got a friend?
Oh, and she's gorgeous.
Oh, what am I rushing for? I'm married. I'm so absent-minded. But I'll tell you one thing, Harris. We got to work fast if we expect any more help from our financial baker, Mr. Backer. I mean, our financial backer, Mr. Baker. Now, help me with this vacuum generator.
Oh, darling, you look tired. You're working too hard, Alex. Much too hard.
I am?
Yeah, look at those bags under Harris's eyes.
Oh, well, he got those on his own time. But, darling, I must work hard. I know it's a mad dream. I know it sounds impossible. But I'm going to invent the telephone, or my name ain't Alexander Graham Bell. Come on, Harris. Let's get to work. Come in.
Well, what's this?
This is the laboratory.
Oh, pardon me.
Darn these interruptions. Harris. Mr. Harris. Mr. Harris, hand me that annunciator magneto.
Here you are.
Hello? Oh, hello, Barbara.
Now, hand me that vibrator.
Okay, Alex.
Did you have a good time last night? Who was there?
Oh, it still won't regenerate.
They were?
Hand me some more of that copper wire.
Here you are, Professor.
Well, look, Barbara, we'd love to come over, but Alex is still working on that invention of his.
How's it coming, Professor?
I'm afraid it won't work, Harris. I'm afraid it's a failure.
Oh, it's some gadget he calls a telephone, but it'll never be a success.
I got another idea, Harris. Hand me that rheostat.
All right, Barbara, I'll call you later. Goodbye.
I don't know, Harris. The more I work on this, the tougher it seems to get. Sometimes I get so discouraged.
Don't give up, Prof.
I won't. Come in. Well, hello, Mr. Baker.
Hello, Alex. How's everything coming along?
I'm making great progress, Mr. Baker. Great progress. You see, it's my theory that if I could make a current of electricity vary in intensity precisely as the air varies in density during the production of multiple sounds, I should be able to transmit speech electromagnetically.
Oh, you can talk plainer, Nat.
But unfortunately, Mr. Baker, my financial resources are depleted. And before I can continue with my experiment, I must have additional monetary aid.
You mean more cash-a-roo?
That's a bullseye if I ever heard one.
Well, how much do you want?
$4 million.
Yes!
Oh, I know. I know that sounds like a lot. But you've already given me $32. What's $4 million? What do you say? Why don't you gamble with me?
You said I was too young.
That was in the first routine. Oh, Mr. Baker, if I don't get the money from you, where else can I get it?
You mean I'm the only sucker in the world?
Yes.
All right then, Alex, I'll give it to you.
Hooray! Did you hear that, darling? Did you hear that, Harris? He's going to give us $4 million.
Here you are, Professor. $1, $2, $3, $4, $5, $6, $10.
2 years later.
$1,993. $1,994. $1,995. $1,995.
4 years later.
$3,999,998.
Yes?
$3,999,999.
Yes, yes.
And 40 cents. I don't think I can make it.
Well, that's close enough. Thanks.
Well, I gotta go now. Goodbye.
Oh, wait a minute, Mr. Baker. Where can I reach you in case I need you again?
In the poorhouse. So long.
Oh, boy. $4 million. I wonder how he could carry so much money in his pockets.
He's got 2 pair of pants.
Oh. Well, Harris, we've got the money. You know what that means? You know what all this money means to us?
Yes, I can tie a can to my orchestra.
Yes, thank heaven. And it also means that I can finish my work, complete my invention. The telephone must and will be perfected. Let's go.
And on March 10th, 1876, in a public auditorium in Boston, Massachusetts, the first telephone, a crude instrument, stands on the desk before Professor Bell. For the first time in history, he is about to transmit the human voice.
Quiet, gentlemen, please. Now, gentlemen, all I ask of you is to have patience. You are about to witness the most amazing demonstration of our time. Gentlemen, please.
Bring it on. What are you stalling for? Yippee!
Young man, I'm introducing a telephone, not a fan dancer. Now, gentlemen, in just a moment, I will transmit my voice by wire to Professor Homer J. Osgood, who is waiting on the other end of this line in Baltimore, 500 miles away. Silence, please. All right, gentlemen, the experiment begins. Mr. Harris, lift the receiver.
Yes, Professor.
Hello. Hello, Baltimore. Baltimore, hello. Hello, Baltimore. Hello, Baltimore. This will work. This must work. Hello, Baltimore. Baltimore, hello.
Did you put a nickel in?
Quiet. Gentlemen, please. Please, give me a chance. Hello. Hello, Baltimore. Baltimore, hello.
Boston Meat Market, your order, please.
Get off the line. I want Baltimore. Don't worry, gentlemen, I'll get it. Hello. Hello, Baltimore. Hello. Hello.
Jello.
I said hello.
And I said jello.
Hang up. I want Baltimore. Don't get disgusted, gentlemen. This will work. This must work. Hello. Hello, Baltimore. Baltimore, hello. Baltimore, hello. 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 Hello.
Hello, friends.
At long. At last, Professor Osgood, can you hear me?
What?
I said, can you hear me? Am I coming over?
Don't come over this week. We got relatives.
I mean, am I coming over the wire? Can you hear my voice?
What?
My voice, my voice.
Oh, my voice, fine. He's in college.
No, 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 not your voice. My voice. Sound, sound.
That's what I said. My son's in college.
Look, Professor Osgood, this is Alexander Graham Bell talking. This is important. This is for the advancement of science. Now, if you can hear me, repeat this sentence. I hear you clearly. Have you got that?
I hear you clearly.
I love you dearly.
Hooray! There you are, gentlemen. The telephone is a success. Hooray! Oh, what a triumph. What a dramatic situation. What a picture this would make.
I'll buy it.
Thank you, Mr. Zanuck. Play, Phil.
I bet a lot of you men heard this line today. Say, Daddy, can we please go for an automobile ride? Well, next time that happens and you get home kind of tired and hot, ask your wife for this cool, refreshing Jell-O dessert, Jell-O a la mode. She won't mind, for it's quick and easy to make. Dissolve one package of raspberry Jell-O in one pint of hot water. Turn into a shallow pan and chill until firm. Then take a sharp knife and cut the Jell-O into shimmering rose-red cubes. Pile the Jell-O cubes into sherbet glasses and top with the vanilla ice cream, or do it the other way around. Place the ice cream in sherbet glasses and top with Jell-O cubes. It's a swell hot weather dessert and one that's bound to be popular. But here's a special word to wives. Be sure to make your Jell-O a la mode with genuine Jell-O if you want that tempting, delicious, extra rich flavor, that colorful summertime beauty. Ask your grocer tomorrow for raspberry Jell-O.
Number of the 35th program in the new Jell-O series, and we will be with you again next Sunday night at the same time. Now, come on with me, Mary. I'm going over to the police station to get a squad of men to go out and look for my car.
J. Edgar Hoover's in town. Why don't you get him, too?
He's just the man I need. Good night, folks.
Kenny Baker appears on the Jell-O program for courtesy of Mervyn LeRoy Productions.
Snug as a Bug is from the film The Gracie Allen Murder Case. This is the National Broadcasting Company.
This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. What I Saw in America by G.K. Chesterton. Section 2, Chapter 1, Part 2, What is America? Take that innocent question. Are you an anarchist? Which is intrinsically quite as impudent as are you an optimist or are you a philanthropist? I'm not discussing here whether these things are right, but whether most of us are in a position to know them rightly. Now, it is quite true that most Englishmen do not find it necessary to go about all day asking each other whether they are anarchists. It is quite true that the phrase occurs in no British forms that I have seen. But this is not only because most of the Englishmen are not anarchists. It is even more because even the anarchists are Englishmen. For instance, it would be easy to make fun of the American formula by noting that the cap would fit all sorts of bald academic heads. It might well be maintained that Herbert Spencer was an anarchist. It is practically certain that Auberon Herbert was an anarchist, but Herbert Spencer was an extraordinarily typical Englishman of the nonconformist middle class, and Auberon Herbert was an extraordinarily typical English aristocrat of the old and genuine aristocracy. Everyone knew in his heart that the squire would not throw a bomb at the queen, and the nonconformist would not throw a bomb at anybody. Everyone knew that there was something subconscious in a man like Auberon Herbert which would have come out only in throwing bombs at the enemies of England, as it did come out in his son and namesake, the generous and unforgotten, who fell flinging bombs from the sky far beyond the German line. Everyone knows that normally, in the last resort, the English gentleman is patriotic. Everyone knows that the English nonconformist is national, even when he denies that he is patriotic. Nothing is more notable, indeed, than the fact that nobody is more stamped with the mark of his own nation than the man who says that there ought to be no nations. Somebody called Cobden the international man, but no man could be more English than Cobden. Everyone recognizes Tolstoy as the iconoclast of all patriotism, but nobody could be more Russian than Tolstoy. In the old countries where there are these national types, the types may be allowed to hold any theories. Even if they hold certain theories, they are unlikely to do certain things. So the conscientious objector, in the English sense, may be and is one of the peculiar by-products of England. But the conscientious objector will probably have a conscientious objection to throwing bombs. Now I am very far from intending to imply that these American tests are good tests, or that there is no danger of tyranny becoming the temptation of America. I shall have something to say later on about that temptation or tendency. Nor do I say that they apply consistently this conception of a nation with the soul of a church, protected by religious and not racial selection. If they did apply that principle consistently, they would have to exclude pessimists and rich cynics who deny the democratic ideal. An excellent thing, but a rather improbable one. What I say is that when we realize that this principle exists at all, we see the whole position in a totally different perspective. We say that the Americans are doing something heroic, or doing something insane, or doing it in an unworkable or unworthy fashion, instead of simply wondering what the devil they are doing. When we realize the democratic design of such a cosmopolitan commonwealth, and compare it with our insular reliance or instincts, we see at once why such a thing has to be not only democratic but dogmatic. We see why, in some points, it tends to be inquisitive or intolerant. Anyone can see the practical point by merely transferring into private life a problem like that of the two academic anarchists who might, by a coincidence, be called the two Herberts. Suppose a man said, "Buffle, my old Oxford tutor, wants to meet you. I wish you'd ask him down for a day or two. He has the oddest opinions, but he's very stimulating." It would not occur to us that the oddity of the Oxford Don's opinions would lead him to blow up the house, because the Oxford Don is an English type. Suppose somebody said, "Do let me bring old Colonel Robinson down for the weekend. He's a bit of a crank, but quite interesting." We should not anticipate the colonel running amuck with a carving knife and offering up human sacrifice in the garden, for these are not among the daily habits of an old English colonel, and because we know his habits, we do not care about his opinions. But suppose somebody offered to bring a person from the interior of Kamchatka to stay with us for a week or two, and added that his religion was very extraordinary religion. We should feel a little more inquisitive about what kind of religion it was. If somebody wished to add Harry Anu to the family party at Christmas, explaining that his point of view was so individual and interesting, we should want to know a little more about it and him, we should be tempted to draw up as fantastic an examination paper as presented to the immigrant going to America. We should ask what a hairy Anu was, and how hairy he was, and above all, what sort of Anu he was. Would etiquette require us to ask him to bring his wife, and if we did ask him to bring his wife, how many wives would he bring? In short, as in the American formula, is he a polygamist? Merely as a point of housekeeping and accommodation, the question is not irrelevant. Is hairy Anu content with hair, or does he wear any clothes? If the police insist on his wearing clothes, will he recognize the authority of the police? In short, as in American formula, is he an anarchist? Of course, this generalization about America, like other historical things, is subject to all sorts of cross divisions and exceptions, to be considered in their place. The Negroes are a special problem because of what white men in the past did to them. The Japanese are a special problem because of what men fear that they in the future may do to white men. The Jews are a special problem because of what they and the Gentiles in the past, present, and future seem to have the habit of doing to each other. But the point is not that nothing exists in America except this idea. It is that nothing like this idea exists anywhere except in America. This idea is not internationalism. On the contrary, it is decidedly nationalism. The Americans are very patriotic and wish to make their new citizens patriotic Americans. But it is the idea of making a new nation, literally out of any old nation, that comes along. In a word, what is unique is not America, but what is called Americanization. If we understand nothing till we understand the amazing ambition to Americanize the Kamskatkan and Harry Anu, we are not trying to Anglicize thousands of French cooks or Italian organ grinders. France is not trying to Gallicize thousands of English trippers or German prisoners of war. America is the one place in the world where this process, healthy or unhealthy, possible or impossible, is going on. And the process, as I have pointed out, is not internationalization. It would be truer to say it is the nationalization of the internationalized. It is making a home out of vagabonds and a nation out of exiles. This is what at once illuminates and softens the moral regulations which we may really think faddist or fanatical. They are abnormal, but in one sense, this experiment of a home for the homeless is abnormal. In short, it has long been recognized that America was an asylum. It is only since Prohibition that it has looked a little like a lunatic asylum. It was before sailing for America, as I have said, that I stood with the official paper in my hand and these thoughts in my head. It was while I stood on English soil that I passed through the two stages of smiling and then sympathizing, of realizing that my momentary amusement at being asked if I were not an anarchist was partly due to the fact that I was not an American. And in truth, I think there are some things a man ought to know about America before he sees it. What we know of a country beforehand may not affect what we see that it is, but it will vitally affect what we appreciate it for being, because it will vitally affect what we expect it to be. I can honestly say that I had never expected America to be what 9/10 of the newspaper critics invariably assume it to be. I never thought it was a sort of Anglo-Saxon colony, knowing that it was more and more thronged with crowds of very different colonists. During the war, I felt that the very worst propaganda for the Allies was the propaganda for the Anglo-Saxons. I tried to point out that, in one way, America is nearer to Europe than England is. If she is not nearer to Bulgaria, she is nearer to Bulgars. If she is not nearer to Bohemia, she is nearer to Bohemians. In my New York hotel, the head waiter in the dining room was a Bohemian. The lead waiter in the grill room was a Bulgar. Americans have nationalities at the end of the street, which for us are at the ends of the earth. I did my best to persuade my countrymen not to appeal to the American as if he were a rather dowdy Englishman, who had been rusticating in the provinces and had not heard the latest news about the town. I shall record later some of those arresting realities which the traveller does not expect, and which, in some cases, I fear, he actually does not see because he does not expect. I shall try to do justice to the psychology of what Mr. Belloc has called the eye-openers in travel. But there are some things about America that a man ought to see even with his eyes shut. One is that a state that came into existence solely through its repudiation and abhorrence of the British Crown is not likely to be a respectful copy of the British Constitution. Another is that the chief mark of the Declaration of Independence is something that is not only absent from the British Constitution, but something which all our constitutionalists have invariably thanked God with the jolliest boasting and bragging that they had kept out of the British Constitution. It is the thing called abstraction or academic logic. It is the thing which such jolly people call theory, and which those who can practice it call thought. And the theory or thought is the very last to which English people are accustomed, either by their social structure or their traditional teaching. It is the theory of equality. It is the pure, classic conception that no man must aspire to be anything more than a citizen, and that no man should endure to be anything less. It is by no means especially intelligible to an Englishman who tends at his best to the virtues of the gentleman and at his worst to the vices of the snob. The idealism of England, or, if you will, the romance of England, has not been primarily the romance of the citizen. But the idealism of America, we may safely say, still revolves entirely round the citizen and his romance. The realities are quite another matter, and we shall consider in its place the question of whether the ideal will be able to shape the realities or will merely be beaten shapeless by them. The ideal is besieged by inequalities of the most towering and insane description in the industrial and economic field. It may be devoured by modern capitalism, perhaps the worst inequality that ever existed among men. Of all that we shall speak later. But citizenship is still the American ideal. There is an army of actualities opposed to that ideal, but there is no ideal opposed to that ideal. American plutocracy has never got itself respected like English aristocracy. Citizenship is the American ideal, and it has never been the English ideal. But it is surely an ideal that may stir some imaginative generosity and respect in an Englishman, if he will condescend to be also a man. In this vision of molding many peoples into the visible image of the citizen, he may see a spiritual adventure which he can admire from the outside, at least as much as he admires the valor of the Moslems, and much more than he admires the virtues of the Middle Ages. He need not set himself to develop equality, but he need not set himself to misunderstand it. He may at least understand what Jefferson and Lincoln meant, and he may possibly find some assistance in this task by reading what they said. He may realize that equality is not some crude fairy tale about all men being equally tall or equally tricky, which we not only cannot believe, but cannot believe in anybody believing. It is an absolute of morals by which all men have a value invariable and indestructible, and a dignity as intangible as death. He may at least be a philosopher and see that equality is an idea, and not merely one of these soft-headed skeptics who, having risen by low tricks to high places, drink bad champagne in tawdry hotel lounges, and tell each other 20 times over with unwearied iteration that equality is an illusion. In truth, it is inequality that is the illusion. The extreme disproportion between men that we seem to see in life is a thing of changing lights and lengthening shadows, a twilight full of fancies and distortions. We find a man famous and cannot live long enough to find him forgotten. We see a race dominant and cannot linger to see it decay. It is the experience of men that always returns to the equality of men. It is the average that ultimately justifies the average man. It is when men have seen and suffered much, and come at the end of more elaborate experiments, that they see men as men under an equal light of death and daily laughter, and none the less mysterious for being many. Nor is it in vain that these Western Democrats have sought the blazonry of their flag in that great multitude of immoral lights that endure behind the fires we see, and gathered them into the corner of Old Glory, whose ground is like the glittering night. For veritably in the spirit, as well as in the symbol, suns and moons and meteors pass and fill our skies with a fleeting and almost theatrical conflagration. And wherever the old shadow stoops upon the earth, the stars return. The end of section 2, end of chapter 1.